Where is your mind while you're at work? Do you ever feel like you're just getting by or barely managing to hold on and hold it together? I'm Ilana Afrika Bredenkamp. Welcome to Mind at Work. In this series, we explore the mental hurdles we face in the workplace and how understanding our minds can lead to real, lasting solutions. Our guest on Mind at Work is a psychotherapist and her name is Andy Cohen. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
What a title. Am I getting in my own way at work? Sure. That's our topic for today. Andy Cohen is a psychotherapist. What does a psychotherapist do?
So a psychotherapist essentially helps you with your feelings. My kids would say, like, I'm a feelings doctor.
Got it.
So I'm interested in your mind and the kind of 360-degree version of you, inside and outside. And very importantly, I'm interested in the unconscious things that motivate us.
I realized that from your keynote, like when you are saying, am I getting in the way of my work or am I getting in the way at work? You know, somehow it does remind me almost of going back to childhood. Surely these feelings of neglect or even rejection, something that I spoke to my kids about this morning, surely it comes from somewhere. How does our childhood experiences, how do they influence where we are as a professional working adult?
So I think the illusion is that you like arrive in the workplace as a fully formed adult. You know, you've studied and that's all you need to equip yourself to be out there in the world and to do your job well. But like you didn't arrive as a robot. You didn't just like download how to do the job. Maybe the skills you learned how to do the job, but the things that you sort of tune into in the workplace that help you understand people, help you understand how to get your needs met, how to like work with a system, you know, just that human relatedness, all of that is coming from, you know, the depths of yourself from, I don't know, 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago. So we can't escape our past selves. They live in the present with us and very much influence how we bring ourselves to work on any given day. Even the kind of work that you might be interested in, it's got nothing to, you know, it could be the job and it's interesting and good money, blah, blah, but it's informed by decisions you made when you were a baby, sorry to say.
So even the job that I'm in today and my behavior at work could be something that was regulated when I was really, really small. Can one change that?
You can change it. You just have to really understand it. You can't self-correct what you can't self-observe. So if you can get to understand why you were drawn into a position, why you've sought out a particular kind of area, let's say, and then link it to what matters to you, because that's at the heart of it. Like what matters to you? How are you going to get your needs met in the world? Then, I mean, I actually think that's the best way because then your work has meaning. I think that's the best kind of work, you know, where you can link it to something inside yourself.
Everyone's going on this whole know yourself, you know, self-work. Wait, when I mention self-work on air, my listeners, it's like my favorite word, resilience. I do not like the word resilience. I think resilience has made me resilient to the word resilience.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
When do we get to know ourselves when our lives are so busy? Like now I still need to do self-work to understand myself so that I can show up right at work. Show up, stand up, get up, you know. We're always in this war zone of like fighting and having to always arrive ready.
Yeah.
So when do we have the time to know ourselves in order to arrive ready?
Yeah, it's like you're saying that self-work is more work. You know, you already got a job. Like, can we just sort of like, you know, park that?
Yeah.
But I feel like, let me say it to you like this. You know how someone says, you know, I did yoga today and I do yoga once a week. And you go, cool. How come you don't have more? Or someone says, I run once every 2 weeks. And they're like, is that all? Right? Like we're so okay with doing yoga or exercise 4, 5, 6 times a week. That is so respected. But don't we live in our minds as much as we live in our bodies?
Oh, yeah.
And I feel like it really needs to be a priority. It's so important to figure out why you do what you do, why you worried about what you worried about, you know? And so I feel like, yeah, it is a luxury, but it also is a necessity to be able to carve out regular time to think. And the beauty of doing that is that then you are freed up to just work. Otherwise, you're going to take your stuff into your job and that can get in the way.
What does self-regulate mean? I'll tell you why I'm asking the question. So you're talking about knowing yourself, and I'm thinking about self-regulation. We did a podcast on self-regulation in one of our baby support for parents podcasts. And in there, we were talking about children speaking to themselves, you know, like the odd mumble that you do when something's really nice or when something's not nice, when it's not pleasing to you.
Yeah.
So in terms of regulation in the workplace, because where I'm going with this is soon I want to talk about regulating our emotions, you know, so that I don't shout at my colleague or I, someone today told me they're very unhappy about something. And I had to be empathetic, even though I thought it was the silliest thing possible, you know, but I had to self-regulate to not say this is really silly, because for that person, it was really important and I had to listen. So let's backtrack. I want to start with self-regulation. What would self-regulation be for an adult?
Okay. So self-regulation would be what you just described. It's that you can kind of notice your feeling and your thought in the moment. You can connect with it. And you can simmer something down. You can like bring the temperature down so that you don't act out, you're not erratic or you're not emotional or I don't know, any of the number of things that can make things go wrong in a kind of professional situation, right? But you have to have learned how to do that back in the day. That's like a developmental milestone that everybody would have needed to kind of internalize actually as a baby.
Right.
So the way that would work is there's a concept in psychoanalysis called containment. And that's that process where, you know, the baby's lying in the cot and the baby is hungry and waiting for mom and the baby's screaming. Like you've heard a baby scream, it is raging. It's raging mad, right? And the baby is screaming and raging like that because they don't know where mom is or if the food's going to come, and it's actually a survival issue. You know, it's not just I'm irritated. Like I might die. You know, it's urgent. And so what the baby will do is it will scream, mom will hear, eventually come. And then that process of the mom picking up the baby and you know, like patting the baby to sleep or patting the baby to calm her down so that she can wait and then giving her the bottle, that process, the mom is helping the baby regulate because she can't regulate herself yet, right? So there's that kind of physical contact and that repetitive action that's happening. But what's also happening and what a lot of people don't know about is that something unconsciously is happening between the carer and the baby in those moments. It's happening on an unconscious level, where the mom is taking the big angry feelings that have been shoved into her, that anxiety feeling you feel when a baby screams, that, and calming down, calming herself down, holding the baby, loving the baby in spite of the big terrifying feeling, saying, it's okay, I'm not scared, we're going to be fine. And then everybody calms down.
Right.
If that process happens enough times in a good enough way, when a baby is a baby, the child starts to internalize, my feelings are okay, I can bring myself out of this, things aren't life-threatening. That's the message that gets laid down. Big feelings aren't life-threatening. And then you carry that in your life. Like that becomes something it's lodged inside you as like a blueprint to cope. And it will happen anywhere. It will happen, you know, at your dinner table, but it can easily happen at work. So that when you notice that someone really, really upsets you, or like a colleague shouts at you or raises their voice, or you want to raise your voice because you've got that same old angry feeling, it's not life-threatening.
No.
So it's all in perspective and you can just bring the whole temperature down. But, you know, it's an old thing. You had to learn that a long time ago.
So if I didn't learn to regulate as a baby, is this a skill that I can adapt later on in life in the workplace? So assume that in the workplace, I think everything is life-threatening. I think if people are talking on the floor, they're talking about me, for instance, or at the water cooler. We actually have a real question of someone saying, everyone got a raise except me. You know, unless everyone is discussing it with you, but if it's just my assumption, right, that everyone has gotten this raise and I'm suffocating, I'm thinking, what about me?
Yeah.
Is that regulation?
So that is, I mean, that's paranoia. I mean, that's really worrying. That's having a constant feeling like you're not getting what someone else is getting. So that is something relational. It's something to do with, I mean, if I can imagine, I can create a scenario out of what you've told me. Let's say that person comes from a really big family where there was not enough food to go around when they were younger, or there was always a competition for mom or dad's attention. Then the message that gets laid down is, I don't get what I need. There isn't enough to go around.
Right.
So, yeah, you can learn how to deal with it, but you first have to know that this feeling about my raise is not because people are greedy. It's because I am scanning my environment all the time to check that, to make sure that I'm going to get enough. And that does not come from this business. This comes, yeah, it's here, but it was also, I had the same problem when I didn't feel like I was invited to enough play dates when I was younger. And I had the same problem when I was sitting at a dinner table and wasn't second helpings.
Or I had the same problem when I was at my previous job.
Exactly. So that's the other thing. You know, if you're in multiple jobs and you notice you have the same frustration, you never get paid enough, you never get enough opportunities, you never get enough working capital, you never get... That might not be the job. That might be something in you.
Right.
And it's important. It matters. Those repetitions, those... Freud called it the repetition compulsion, where you constantly find yourself landing up in the same situation over and over again, and it exhausts you and it worries you and you think the world's out to get you. But actually, it's you coming up against these same scenarios again. It's almost like the record scratched. So you like go around and then you bump back and then you go around and you bump back. And that is your mind's way of trying to push you in a direction so that you see we've got a problem here. We need to sort it out. It's a sign. It's a signal that there's something wrong. Like the record is replaying in the wrong, you know, we can't play the rest of the song. So that's usually a signal that it's time to like start trying to ask questions about what I'm doing and why I'm doing it, you know, and taking some, you know, owning some of it, I think.
So in a while, we'll get back to how we can fix that record and how we can make it, let's call it palatable. Stay with the music theme. It's to make the music sound digestible to for everyone. So self-regulation, and this is quite interesting. So, I mean, never did I think we'd actually talk about growing up, because self-regulation is a tool for me. For some of us, we just assume that we can, you know, that it comes naturally. This know yourself notion and self-regulation as a working adult, is it a skill that one can learn? So so let's say we see a therapist or someone that can educate us around us. How would we go about to learn? Where would you learn the skill from?
You absolutely can learn it, but you have to do it with another person because it's interpersonal. So my sense is, like, so I'm a psychotherapist, and, you know, I said that that's got you interested in the unconscious dynamics, but the relationship is core in our work. So I work with a small amount of people for a long period of time. We get into a relationship. We're in something together. We are very committed to the work and to knowing this person well. And it's in that process of relating and feeling things off each other and understanding what that means and really, like, that containment thing, you know, with the baby bird and the mommy bird metabolizing, you're almost like replaying that process, but in a therapeutic way now, with someone who can think for you now in a way that you never got. So it's very reparative. Psychotherapy and psychoanalysis, that's the kind of at the heart of what we do. We use that kind of relating to repair what you didn't get, or you didn't understand, or you misunderstood, or whatever you made of it back in the day.
So this relational interaction, mom and baby, what baby didn't get at the time, baby grows up and now we're in the workplace and something frustrates me, and how I show up is something that could possibly not be new. It definitely could relate to how I was nurtured and cared for and some of the triggers as a child.
Yes. Yes. It is what happened to you, what your environment was. So there is that kind of environmental stuff. It's also what you made of it.
Okay.
So it's something that happens on the outside, but it's also internally, individually, what your personality did with it, what you, what assumptions you made. Like, I'll give you an example. Like my daughter was learning how to swim, and I promise you, for months, she wasn't putting her face in the water. And at one point, it was actually hampering her ability to swim because she couldn't go kind of horizontal, right? So at one point, I was like, I've just asked her, why wouldn't you put your face in the water? And she said, because my eyes will fall out.
Okay.
Right. So I was like, oh, okay, no, they won't. And then I explained to her that your eyes are attached to the inside of your head. And, you know, and then she was like, oh, okay, cool. And then she put her face in and she learned how to swim quite quickly. The thing is, like, a young mind, a baby's mind, a toddler's mind, a 2-, 3-, 4-year-old, they don't have common sense yet. They don't have life experience. So they're forming opinions based on their own fantasized logic.
Right.
Now, can you imagine that that logic is being laid down inside you as a blueprint, and then you're working with that logic in the workplace. So, you know, let's say somebody doesn't give you enough, you don't get second helpings when you are 3 years old and you're starving and you want it, then what logic? I don't know. You might say, you know, I'm not good enough. Mm. That's why I didn't get it. You know, I don't deserve to have the seconds. Or I was feeling angry at my brother at the same time as the food. Oh, angry feelings are the reason I didn't get the food. Now, the rest of your life, you are worried about having a lot.
Right.
But it's unconscious because you have laid down that decision. It's a problem you can't solve, and then it goes underground into your unconscious mind. Mm. And it governs your decisions. It governs your dynamics at work, and it really can hold you back, you know, and it doesn't need to, because it actually matters. And if you can understand it, there is so much opportunity, and then you get freed up. It frees you up. If you know what it is, and you can sort of, it's not about breaking ties with the past, but it's about understanding the link so intently that it can just live there. And like you can,
and you don't have to judge or discriminate against.
No,
you don't have to blame yourself or your mother.
No. Well, we can try to do that, but it's, you know,
it's not helpful.
Yeah, it gets stale quickly, you know. But I think the thing is, it's like you got to respect it, and you respect that, and that you like you understand something about yourself, and then it's like when that feeling rises up again, which it will, you can go, "Hello, old friend. Mm. Yeah, we know each other, but we're not doing that today because actually I've got work to do," and you get on with it.
Well, you can speak to that old friend when you get home, because maybe that friend needs a good talking to.
Totally. Or you bring it up with your therapist the next day.
Right.
You know, I caught something. I noticed I nearly lost it at work today, but actually it was that thing. That thing happened again.
Yeah.
You know?
We had a question around common red flags. So my question to you is, what is considered a red flag? I mean, it's such a vague, what is a red flag at work? Like, are we talking emotional imbalances? Are we talking... So if you think your colleagues, well, flashing red, you know?
Yeah.
What are we talking about?
So, I mean, I guess that would be like somebody with kind of behavior that you don't like, maybe.
Let's call it feelings.
Yeah. So there would be feelings, right? Because if a person, it's your feelings or their feelings. But I think feelings at work is like it's a complex thing. You know, I think we wish to be able to put feelings aside and keep business and keep personal separate. We do that kind of like concrete thing where we feelings aren't
draw
allowed.
A line in the sand.
Yeah. But I think there's nothing wrong with feelings being in the workplace as long as everybody's got a handle on their feelings. You know, then it's useful. Then actually it's the thing that drives people, you know. Like you come to work, you're passionate about your job, you know, like it matters to you. You bring your caring self into your office. There's nothing wrong with having feelings. I think that the trouble is when the feelings are too big, or when the feelings are undefined. So like for me, anxiety is like not everybody thinks this way, but the way I think of anxiety is it's not a feeling. I think anxiety is a scanning. It's a state. It's a state of checking and scanning your environment for danger.
Right.
And it's also a state of not thinking. It's a way of booting out the real feelings, the other feelings to the back of your mind and just sort of not thinking about stuff. And I think anxiety is dangerous because then you start to look for the reason in the wrong place, you know, and it's really important to be able to understand what the feeling means.
So anxiety is this umbrella term. It's not, anxiety doesn't mean you're scared. So you're scanning
to see what the problem is. I feel like anxiety is like a state, right? So it's like a looking around from here to there and like checking for what's wrong? What could go wrong next? It's like a future scanning type of thing. And then what lands up happening, if you think about the last time you were anxious, you try to solve the problem. So you think, oh, it's because I'm on deadline and I just need to finish this one project. And then you finish it and you get like 1 minute of relief. And then the feeling rises up in you again. And then you think, oh, no, it's because, you know, I'm going to miss my kids' show because I have to be at this meeting. And then the show comes and goes and the feeling doesn't leave, or you get a tiny bit of relief. So in that way, like anxiety, it's like a hopscotch of thought, you know, where it doesn't rest on any, like a frog almost, like jumping from lily pad to lily pad, and it doesn't rest for a long time. If you think about what that is actually doing, you're not thinking about anything. Mm-hmm. It's a state of unthinking. And so what it's actually doing is it's hiding something underneath the lily pads. And there is a logic to the things that are worrying you, but it's unconscious.
Right.
And if you think about it, it's not in the mind yet. It's not in thought. It's sitting, like, you know, when you feel anxious, you don't feel like intellectually anxious. You feel it in your body. It's in your chest or your throat
or your stomach.
It's a body feeling. It's not thought yet. So,
the way you explain it about that, it's unthinkable almost.
It is unthinkable.
You can't speak it yet.
It is. It's not verbal.
Mm.
So it's sitting in your body and it's looking to come out. It's pushing.
So if we think of all of that and all these emotions, you know, we've had beautiful messages from our listeners. How much of it do we show up with at work? I mean, do we expose our feelings to our colleagues at work if we all want to be these educated beings that understands different people in the workplace? Actually, I had this conversation with one of my leadership the other day where I said to him, do you become vulnerable in your meetings? Because we talked about, you know, the way our leadership show up, because they always have to be strong.
Mm.
And he actually said to me, you know what, Alana, the other day I broke down in a meeting.
Mm.
And afterwards you overthink it. You think, you know what, should I have cried? Should I have not? You know, do they respect me more?
Mm.
And I think they do. I think your colleagues or your team, they do respect you more because you showed that you're not just wanting them to be perfect the whole time, you know?
Yeah. Listen, as a general mantra, I think feelings are fine. I don't think feelings, there's anything wrong with feelings. I think there are appropriate places to explore these things. I think you also want to, you know, have your privacy. And it's important to have a place parallel where you can think about things in depth and not sort of bring that to work, you know, because I think you don't want it to get out of hand either. So, but I don't think there's anything wrong with having a feeling and telling your boss how you feel about something. One just needs to be professional, right? Like, you need to have a set of skills alongside that to be able to say, you know, I felt this and can you help me make that better, you know? Or I feel really disappointed that I didn't get a raise.
Mm.
It doesn't mean you're going to get it, right? But you might be able to express it if you've got a good relationship
right. With
your boss. And, you know, then they might say, thank you for sharing that with me, that I really understand and I feel terrible. There's nothing I can do, but it's good for me to know where you're at. You know, that's just two human beings hearing each other out. I think there's nothing wrong with that.
Talking about skills, in one of our other podcasts with Laurie Milner, we're talking about skills in the workplace and how you can actually practice these skills with your colleagues. But back to our personal bodies, you know, immediately when you talked about feelings, it's like that irritation, you know, that trigger.
Yes.
Personal triggers. How do I understand my own? Do we call them triggers? Could I be a trigger for someone at work?
Could well be. I mean, it's not necessarily your problem if you're someone else's trigger, unless you have to work with them closely. You know, then you might need to get in a room together, might need to have someone facilitate and help
figure out. An intervention. I like that.
Because I think the truth is, like, at work, you don't function as an island, right? You're working with someone else or with a team. That's relational. And that is always going to echo something from your very early relationships and your early family, like your sibling dynamics, for example. So any stuff that you might have had, like from your family or between you and your parents, like where there's like, let's say, a power struggle or power dynamics where one person is strong and one person is weak, is going to evoke all your early childhood stuff around how you related to your parents and being helpless or vulnerable. And the way we work all of that stuff out is in our families. That's our first experience of being on a team, right? So that stuff is going to come up.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm not suggesting you go and psychoanalyze your coworker, right? Like, there are other places and forums for that, right? But it's good to be able to observe it in yourself. You know, it's so interesting. Like, he gets my back up every time, but he reminds me of my older brother.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's useful. I don't know if you need to go tell the guy that.
I don't think
he's going to want to hear, you know? Like, I don't, you know, you might, I don't advise that.
Mm-hmm.
But if you can take that somewhere else to interrogate it a little bit, it means something and it matters and you can get to the bottom of something. You can actually understand yourself better and actually have a more pleasant day at work because you'll walk past him in the hallway and he won't bother you so much, you know?
Good advice. Take it elsewhere.
Mm.
And that, Andy, didn't mean like to the bar or...
No, I didn't.
There's wonderful advice and we'll get to that just now.
I think on that point, sorry, if I could say, you know, take it to the bar or, you know, take it to on the run or take it, you know, go meditate. Those things are all useful, but those are monologues. The thing that helps with this kind of problem is a dialogue. You need to be talking with someone and talking it out because otherwise beliefs that you formed around this thing are, you know, my
one-sided,
eyes
will one-sided. Yeah,
they're one-sided, and my eyes will fall out of the water. My
perspectives,
eyes,
yeah.
Perspectives. It was for, you know, so you need to reality check with someone who can think with you, right? Mm. So that's the other thing, like the dialogue really matters.
So let's stay with the dialogue. I mean, we understand now the personal triggers, or let's call them patterns. Could we call them that?
Yeah. Listen, patterns are, for me, at the heart of everything. Freud called it repetition compulsion. It's the record scratch. Where you notice that throughout your life, there are these similar things that are happening over and over and over again. You might notice it more like in a concrete external way, like I don't get the raise, I never get enough. But it's also, there's a feeling behind that. It's like, I just feel unsatisfied all the time.
I never feel full.
You know, maybe you even like have like eating stuff, you know, when you're eating, you know, or you like have trouble with your weight, you know, it sits there. And then it sits also with your partner. You don't get enough time with him.
Mm.
So it will be almost shattered throughout your life. And then this work is about trying to pick up and understand what those patterns are and this repeating, to get to know the repetition, to get curious about the repetition, because it's holding the kind of kernels of what your deepest needs are, actually, and something that really needs to be understood, and like pull those pieces need to be pulled back into one picture again.
So Andy, all of this has got to do with being held back.
Mm.
All of this has got to do with understanding yourself, and with that you'll be able to move forward.
Yeah.
But if I stay with our title, am I getting in my way at work? Am I getting in my own way? You know? Mm. Surely there should be something that I am hiding. Like, what if I just find out what is hiding behind all of that so that I can just be successful and move forward?
Mm. Well, I think that's the dream, actually.
This is your cue. Find out what is holding you back so that you can be present.
Yeah. Okay, so I think at the end of the day, it's your responsibility to find out what's holding you back so that you can live in the present. If you are able to figure out what all that shrapnel is, you can leave it there. You put the picture together and you set it aside, and then you can actually function in a successful way in your present role in whatever it is that you have committed to going forward, without sort of always looking over your shoulder, because that takes up a huge amount of energy, actually. Like our energy is like it's an economy. Like there's only so much to go around. And if you're constantly putting your energy into trying to solve a problem that happened 30 years ago, you're not investing in your current role the way you should be. And that's where you're holding yourself back. You have to be able to kind of do yourself the service of parking that old stuff. And that's not putting it out of mind. It's getting to know it so well that it doesn't worry you anymore, or that you can accept something or mourn something, because that's also part of the work.
Sure. Find out what is holding you back so that you can be present.
Yeah.
You mentioned earlier that there is this dialogue that needs to happen so that you don't feel in the way of yourself at work, so that you don't feel like you can't.
Mm.
Who do we have that dialogue with? We've established that it's not possible to just have it with a colleague. We've established that it's not a good idea to phone your mom about it.
Mm.
How do we get hold of the right expert in order to take us further?
Yeah. So I'm biased. Mm. I work psychodynamically, but a psychoanalyst or a psychotherapist who is equipped to think in this three-dimensional way, who will be able to hear your problem and understand that it's part of a bigger picture, that there are echoes of what's happening now is an echo of something that many things that have happened long time ago. Analysts and psychotherapists can hear the unconscious. And it's a very specific training. It's also like an analyst is, to my knowledge, it's the only mental health practitioner that has to have their own analysis in order to treat someone. So they have to know the depths of themselves so well that they are equipped to take on whatever a patient brings. So for me, if a listener out there finds themselves noticing these patterns, noticing the overwhelm, being curious in themselves, wanting to kind of take that journey, look for a psychotherapist or a psychoanalyst, because you know that's where you will be able to get the answers you're looking for.
We're a community of inspiration, but we need to be motivated. If you could give one nugget of motivation to everyone at work, I mean, it's tough out there. What would it be?
A nugget of inspiration.
Come on, Andy Cohen.
I can do it.
Yeah.
I think to be curious.
Yeah.
I think to be curious about yourself, like, why are you in the job that you're doing? You know, it could just be money. Even sometimes, you know, being able to bring home a salary at the end of the day can be as satisfying as you need it to be.
Mm.
But to be able to be curious about why you're drawn to the industry you're in, the people that you're working with, why are you there? You know, why does your work matter? Because I think at the end of the day, the best thing you can have is meaningful work, really. Like, I feel like that is such a gift for any person to wake up and to love what they do and to feel passionate and not held back when they get there. For me, that's the, you know, but to be curious about that and curious about yourself and what gets you up in the morning, gets your back up, all the good and the bad, you know?
Andy, thanks for your time.
Oh, thanks for having me.